Good morning, everybody. It is October 18th, 2021. This is the ADK Homeroom, your home away from homeroom. Certainly my home away from homeroom, as I have been exiled from the classroom this year due to the mask mandates. So here we are in our home on the internet. Not as many beautiful signs of autumn on the internet as there are outside in the Adirondacks right now. If you have not made your way up here or to a similarly beautiful place, what the heck are you doing? It's an amazing season. It is absolutely marvelous out there, so go and marvel at it. Had a little bit of rain over the weekend. The dog was pretty much a sopping sponge of dirt and mud rolling around in our house. But that's what you get. That's what you get. As Trace Adkins said, and you're going to miss this. You're going to miss this. Even a sopping wet sponge dog rolling around like one of those kindergartners rolling the sponge brush around on the paper, dog printing dirt everywhere in the house, including on your kindergarten. You're gonna miss it. You gotta enjoy it. It's beautiful. Leaves coming in. Our dog has a lot of fur, and the leaves come in on her, and then the leaves are inside the house. But, you know, just gotta enjoy it. It's part of life. Our topic for today is the China hypersonic missile test. Oh my goodness. To be more precise, it's a fractional orbital bombardment system. Yes, well, we're going to get into that. What is it, and what does it mean for recalibrating, right? If we're going to live life rationally, then we have to constantly be updating our views based on evidence, based on what we see in the real world. This process we can call recalibration. And it needs to be redone all the time. So, what should we be taking away from this Chinese news? Let's begin it here. We're going to go through this in three steps. A, what is it? B, how is it different from traditional systems? How is this fractional orbital bombardment system different from traditional systems? And C, what are the implications of all this? Going through A and B pretty quickly, jump into C pretty quickly, because I think some people have a pretty good idea what A and B are. Here we go. Let's go to A. So it's not just a hypersonic missile like some other programs that are out there. It's a fractional orbital bombardment system. How it worked in the test is you had a system placed on the Long March rocket, the 77th launch of a Long March rocket. Of course, a Long March rocket named after Mao's retreat, really, in the mid-1930s that allowed the Chinese Communist Party to survive, escape. And the Long March rocket, it's telling that the 77th one was not really announced. I guess they announced the 76th launch and the 78th launch, but not the 77th one. And what it did is carried its hybrid system up into a orbit-like path that cannot do a full orbit, but it can do a fraction of an orbit, hence the name. And it moves similar through orbit like a satellite does. In other words, it's moving so quickly in the X direction, if you will, that by the time it falls down to the surface of the Earth, it has gone over the horizon of the Earth. And that's what orbit is, right? If you study physics, that's what an orbit is. It's just that you're moving so quickly sideways that by the time you fall down to the surface of the Earth, you are over the horizon. That's why we can say that you're in free fall when you are in orbit. And that's why there's still a lot of gravity on the space shuttle. People always say, oh, there's no gravity on the space shuttle. Look at them. They're floating around. No, they're only floating because they're in free fall. How can you stay in orbit if you're in free fall? If there's a ton of gravity constantly pulling you toward the center of the Earth, how could you stay in orbit up there? Well, because as you're falling towards the center of the Earth, you're also moving sideways. And by the time you've fallen towards the surface of the Earth to go splat, 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 sticky splat, like the PJ Masks. Bom, bom, ba-dum, bom. By the time you've done a sticky splat on the surface of the earth, you've actually gone so far sideways that the horizon has curved away from underneath you and you stay out in orbit. So this system goes up there. It's in a fractional orbit. And then when it does, it's just floating around up there. That's part of the unpredictability of it here. And then when it decides to strike, it can do so extremely quickly. It releases this hypersonic glide vehicle. It's not completely gliding, but at first it is gliding through the atmosphere, and then it can maneuver, right? It's not just coasting. It's not just a ballistic missile acting only under the influence of gravity. This is part of its trickiness, is that it can maneuver as it goes through, and then this hypersonic glide vehicle zooms in and hits its target. The hypersonic glide vehicle could be outfitted with a nuclear warhead. It could be outfitted with an electro bomb, an E-bomb, an EMP weapon, electromagnetic pulse, a little portable mini Carrington event. I've seen a lot of chat on Twitter that an EMP weapon would in fact be more likely to be installed on this hypersonic glide vehicle. And of course, you know, it's coming in at a very high rate of speed. So the kinetic energy itself, it's being dropped out of orbit here, the kinetic energy itself can pose a significant amount of damage. The higher the mass, obviously, the more, and especially the higher the velocity, the more kinetic energy, the more damage. To some extent, it's like those old science fiction novels you read, right? Where the breakaway colony on the moon or up in orbit decides that it just wants to attack Earth, and its method of doing so is just dropping things, right? It just takes some scrap metal and just drops it down on Earth. And because of the massive kinetic energy that it has dropping in from far, far up in the gravity well, the massive kinetic energy it has just absolutely obliterates its target. So that plays a role too in this hypersonic glide vehicle. So again, to recap, it's a system. What we're talking about here, fractional orbital bombardment system, what we're talking about that China successfully tested in August, is a system. They launched it on a rocket. Eventually, they're going to want to put it somewhere that isn't on a Long March rocket, somewhere on some type of boost vehicle that could fit in their missile silos that they have scattered throughout the country, largely in the West, I believe. So they're going to want to put it in there, the system, into a missile, launch it out of a silo, or of course, ultimately, they would love to have it in portable launchers, but that is further off. So they launch this system up there. It goes into a orbit or a very similar orbit-like path, and then it can float around up there for a while. It is very difficult to predict the exact timing of it. Then it releases, the system releases the hypersonic glide vehicle. It maneuvers under power through the atmosphere toward its target, and it impacts with extremely high kinetic energy, and it can be outfitted with a nuclear warhead or an electromagnetic pulse. So that's what it is. Now let's go to part B here. I said we'd have three parts. What is it? Part B is how is it different? And C, what are the implications? So part B, just in case you don't know, how is it different from what the U.S., what has gone before, what the U.S. has been preparing for? Well, you know, the U.S. defense systems, they pulled a Maginot. They have absolutely built up this Maginot line, and it's not this useless, poo-pooed, silly Maginot line that A Separate Piece talks about. If you read that book, A Separate Piece, and they're like, oh, we can't put up our Maginot lines of the soul. Oh, we have to be open to other people. Oh, don't jounce the limb, Finney. Yeah, well, it's not like that. This Maginot line that the U.S. has put up was effective against ballistic missiles, at least to some extent. It looks north because China was going to be, Russia was going to be in the Cold War, North Korea was going to be possibly launching ballistic missiles from the north over into the United States, coming over Alaska, coming over Canada, down into the United States. A ballistic missile, of course, is really just like throwing a ball up into the air. Once it's boosted, it's just under the influence of gravity, and it follows a parabolic path. This is one reason why you don't like Thomas Pynchon's novel, Gravity's Rainbow. There are a lot of reasons not to like it. But one reason not to like it is that he fails in his central metaphor on mathematical grounds. He calls the path of ballistic missiles a rainbow. Rainbows are circles, and ballistic missiles travel paths that, after their boost stage, are much closer to parabolas, not circles. Sorry, Mr. Pynchon. All right, so the US's system looks north because that's where they expected these ballistic missile threats to be coming from. Like France building that Maginot Line against Germany, and then, of course, Germany just going right around it, coming in through Belgium, start of World War II. Sorry, France. Now, what did you expect, right? That was obvious that Germany would do that. And, of course, it should have been obvious that China, North Korea, Russia would circumvent this northward-looking system that the US has in place. Well, yeah, of course. So that's one new way. One way this is different is that this orbital release system can bombard from any direction. It can come from the south, right? It can come from the west, it can come from the east, it can come from the south. And that's very difficult for the modern US defense system to respond to. Another way it's different is that it's not just under the influence of gravity while it's moving through space. It can come in from any direction, and it can change as it comes in. It is maneuverable. So even if you do see it coming and you can track it moving through space, which is possible, but it's still much harder to shoot down than something coming in that is just coasting and falling. Another difference, similar to the one I just mentioned, the timing is extremely unpredictable. A ballistic missile goes up, you know about how much fuel is in that rocket. You can tell how long the boost stage lasts, and then you can look at the path going through the Earth's atmosphere, falling back into the Earth's atmosphere. That is very predictable. But with the FOBs, the Fractional Orbital Bombardment System, it's not predictable. It can glide around up there for a longer time. It can release at an unpredictable time. It plays heck with your attempts to prognosticate, to predict exactly when it's going to start its attack. And fourth, one of the last differences between what has come before in this fractional orbital bombardment system is that it is really going to use its own kinetic energy, or has the potential to use its own kinetic energy as part of its destructive potential, and it's moving with such high kinetic energy, high velocity, that it is just a moving target. Even if you do predict when it's coming in or you try to account for that, it's moving extremely fast. It has a very high kinetic energy. So some of the systems that we have in place to deal with lower kinetic energy incoming attack vectors are not going to be effective against things that are moving with such extreme kinetic energy, such high velocity. All right, so that's part B. That's how it's very different. Comes in from different angles. Timing is extremely unpredictable, much higher speed, and therefore much higher kinetic energy. And it should be noted, by the way, that this defense system that we have that's looking north, right, hasn't always been in place just for the last few decades. We've had early warning systems facing north for a long time, but being able to shoot down missiles is a relatively new development. Remember, the United States did not even leave the Anti-Ballistic Missile Treaty until 2002, 2003, somewhere right in there. So this anti-ballistic missile technology really is pretty new in terms of the Cold War, in terms of post-World War II geopolitics. All right, now we're on to the meat of the matter here, part C. How should we recalibrate our worldviews? Which worldviews should we recalibrate because of this test, and how should we recalibrate them? Well, it's a little easy to pick out number one. Number one with a hypersonic bullet right here. Your estimate of the U.S. intelligence system. If you had your opinion of the U.S. intelligence system somewhere over in that pretty good range, in that competent to highly competent range, well, you might want to dial that down a little bit there, partner. Yeah, I mean, just look at what's been going on in the past few months even, right? We can't identify what Havana syndrome is. No clue there. None. We've got no answers. People are still coming down with that. They can't protect them, can't stop them, can't even figure out who is doing it. The Taliban in August, apparently our intelligence services were telling President Biden, oh, might be a little bit bad, but you've got months, maybe a year. You certainly, you know, don't have to worry about the horrific scenes with people falling off planes trying to escape the Kabul airport there like we had. You certainly didn't have the intelligence services warning President Biden about that. Absolute dismal failure there. Look, you can't even get Biden specifically and publicly directed the intelligence services to find some academic records on the origin of the COVID virus. And they can't even get academic records. We're not even talking about military records. We're not even talking about foreign intelligence service records. We're talking about records from a biology lab that was so insecure they were doing their own tests at BSL-2. I don't know if there's a similar classification scheme for intelligence protection, but I doubt they were very good at that. And our intelligence services can't even find really actionable information there. And you know it's out there because somebody just leaked the defuse report to Drastic, and that came out, and that was a bombshell in like September. And our intelligence service couldn't even come up with that. Our intelligence services are in a very poor state right now. You can debate why that is, but it's hard to say, very hard to say, that they're effective. When was their last success? Hard to say there, too. Took them 12 years to find bin Laden. That's not a good record. So, in addition to all those things there now, you look at this fractional orbital bombardment system, and according to this Financial Times report that broke the story, completely flat-footed the United States government. They had no idea. They were stunned that China could do this. Flabbergasted. Right? Now, Biden, he looks stunned all the time, so how are you going to tell the difference? But you talk to the other people out there, you can tell when they're stunned. And they were. They had no idea this was going on. They had no idea this was coming. That is an abysmal failure, a colossal, and let's hope not historical, but it certainly could be a historical failure. So that's the first thing that you should recalibrate, your estimate of the U.S. intelligence system. And what should you recalibrate it to? You should recalibrate it to incompetent, right? You can't say it's anything in the competent category. It's incompetent. How many years to fix it? I don't know. Things can happen quickly when they need to, but I would say this is a multi-year problem under normal circumstances. Maybe it could get changed faster than that if some crisis occurred. I don't know. We'll see. All right, next thing, security. Security. How should this recalibrate your view of U.S. national security? Honestly, I wouldn't say a huge change here because this really just sorts of sort of puts you back to 1980 levels, mutually assured destruction, back to the Cold War, back to the place where the U.S. intelligence services were constantly being infiltrated, and the West in general, right? Remember, the British intelligence services were actually being run by the KGB at one point. Unbelievable, but true. Kim Philby and his Ring of Five, if you want to look that up, were really completely controlling the anti-communist effort in British intelligence, and they were communists working with the Soviet Union. So, you know, in some sense, this is not completely unprecedented territory to have incompetent intelligence services in the West. And perhaps our security, national security situation, that's why I'm saying it's not a huge change. It really just kind of goes back to the Cold War, back to maybe 1980 levels. Kim Philby was way back before 1980, but it kind of puts us back in the realm of mutually assured destruction. Now, maybe that is a huge change to you, this going back to the realm of mutually assured destruction, but honestly, I've lived through the Cold War and I'm alive now, and I really haven't felt any different Cold War and now. Maybe other people, were you guys feeling way more secure now than you did during the Cold War? I definitely have not. You know, I maybe that's because I particularly see the risks of biological warfare, natural biological plague, economic collapse. I've long, like for decades, been saying climate change isn't even close to our number one threat. You've got biological warfare. You've got governments committing economic suicide, nuclear, electronic, hybrid warfare, biological warfare, natural biological problems. These sorts of things are far more, AI you could even throw in there, far more pressing than climate change. And so I am constantly seeing the risks out there. But I mean, I'm also, you know, one of these guys who understands that to have professional sports teams in your town, you're going to have a couple thousand more flu deaths, influenza deaths nationwide, right? You can go and look that up. Most people don't seem to have been aware that that having professional sports is going to kill thousands of people per year. So maybe to me, it's not a big change because I've been aware of these threats and these risks. Maybe to a lot of people, it would be a big change. But to me, mutually assured destruction really isn't anything new. I wouldn't put it as a big change. And, you know, to think about it for a second, is this a new era of returning to mutually assured destruction? If China floats this capability out there, it bypasses U.S. defenses. So it's not there yet. It's not there yet, but it sure looks like it might be able to bypass these new U.S. defenses over the last couple of decades. Can the U.S. in turn bypass China defenses? Well, not with a hypersonic missile system like this, not with a system similar to that, because the U.S. has long been behind the game in hypersonic warfare. Russia has hypercavitating torpedoes, right? The U.S. doesn't have anything like that, and the U.S. is behind in terms of this too. But the U.S., you know, we've been playing defense rather than offense to some extent, to a great extent, but that still doesn't mean that we're not in a mutually assured destruction scenario, because the U.S. has 5,000 nuclear warheads. China has official estimates, maybe 500. Personally, given the state of our intelligence agencies, I'd say China probably has closer to 1,000. U.S. has 14 Ohio-class submarines, maybe 20 missiles on each submarine, 4 or 5 warheads each, talking about 1,000, 20%, 25% of our nuclear arsenal could be out on subs. China has 150 cities with 1 million or more people in them. And China does have some ABM capabilities, anti-ballistic missile capabilities, right? Successful test earlier this year in February versus long-range ballistic missile by China. They have their HQ-19 system operational versus medium-range nuclear missiles, 1,000 to 3,000 kilometer missiles. So not all of the 200 or so missiles from the U.S. subs would find their mark in China, but some will. And given the relative size of the nuclear stockpiles, I would say that we really are into a mutually assured destruction type of situation once more. Which brings us to our third point of what we should recalibrate given this news, right? First point was recalibration of the U.S. intelligence system. Second point was recalibration of our security situation. Seems to be more of a mad situation, which again, to me, is not that huge of a change, but maybe it will be to a bunch of people. Third, recalibration, our vision of the future of war, right? There will be another war. Steven Pinker might be right. Wars might be less often, less bloody when in general. But there are always going to be these black swan events, these long tail events. There will be another war at some point. It will change the world. It will kill people. And we need to be prepared for it. What will it look like? Personally, I still think it will look like a war that is decided electronically. And I think that electronic war will be decided quickly in the first couple of days. I don't say the war will be over in the first couple of days, but I think that the electronic part of it, supremacy, will be established in the first couple of days, most likely. And coming back from that, while possible, will be extremely difficult. And over the long stretch of the war after that, it's going to be very difficult to come back from losing the electronic war in the first couple of days. And it could be quick, but I would say the most likely scenario is a quick electronic war establishing supremacy and then a long, drawn out, years long, perhaps, lower grade war of resistance by whichever side lost the electronic war in the first couple of days and suffered massive casualties as a result. So, I still think that is the most likely scenario. And I think that this tilts the favor of winning that initial electronic phase of the war into China's direction. Not saying it shifts it more than 50% in that direction, but it does move the needle toward China, certainly more than it moves it toward the United States. It definitely moves it in the opposite direction. Now, a lot of the chatter on Twitter has been about this electronic warfare and electromagnetic pulse being delivered via this fractional orbital bombardment system. So notice one thing, that this is the way that war has been going. We've been at war. People refuse to acknowledge it, but we've been at war with China and Russia electronically for decades. The U.S. refuses to acknowledge it. I think a lot of people in the U.S. administrations have been so old that they don't even understand that it is a war. They don't even understand that electronic attacks are real attacks. You would think they'd get that, given everything you see around you, but I don't think they do. And so you've got the side of experience being the aggressor in electronic warfare on the side of China, on the side of Russia, and that doesn't bode well. Notice also that electromagnetic pulse weapons are politically far more palatable because you don't kill people with them. You can claim the good guy card. You can say, oh, we're being good. We have to do this for our own national security, but we're not killing anybody over there. We're just disabling all your electronic systems. That is a very plausible statement after an EMP goes off. We were threatened. We didn't want to kill anybody, but we had to protect ourselves. So we just disabled all your electronics. And then, right, the other country is dealing with an electronic crisis and they've lost, right? They just lost the geopolitical upper hand, and the aggressor in that case not only can have a plausible moral excuse that they didn't kill any people, but they've just established geopolitical dominance right there. So that's one way you should look at this and recalibrate your estimate of the vision, or your prediction for the vision of the future of war. Electronically, this definitely moves the needle toward China. If you want to think about the rest of it, if it does come down to hand-to-hand, or if it does come down to some other sort of conventional warfare, I don't think it changes the view of that too much. I think, you know, hand-to-hand, I actually still think the United States would have more advantage there. China's a lot bigger. Population, obviously, is bigger. Standing army, 2.8 million in China to 1.4 million in the United States. But the U.S., unfortunately or not, has a lot more experience with troops in actual combat situations. And experience counts for a lot. And it does depend a little bit on the Chinese super soldier programs, right? They're definitely playing Ender's Game over there. And finally, one interesting implication of this is it actually moves Russia a little bit away from China. Most people will probably think it might solidify them, but Russia does not. Russia's against whoever's in first place, right? Russia does not want anyone to have ascendancy over Russia. And they really only support China just because that's the way to take down the United States. If China ascends into that first place, Russia's commitment to China and alliance with China really starts to erode that and fray. And finally, you know, it's a little hard to predict how Russia would view that China ascendancy in terms of what line, at what point do they think they need to side with the U.S. against China rather than China against the U.S. because they're just out for Russia and they just want to support whoever's in second place as long as they're not the ones in first place. So it's a little bit hard to predict that on Russia's part. But you know what's not hard to predict? India. India would definitely be against China under almost any imaginable circumstance. And India has 2.5 million in its standing army. So that would tend to say that when you imagine future wars, hand-to-hand, conventional, on the ground doesn't look so good for China, which is in fact probably why they are developing this platform. Number four thing to recalibrate is how to prepare for the future war. Every country that wants to win that war, I think every country, you better be planning on winning that electronic warfare in the first couple days of the next war. And B, you need to be preparing for biological warfare because that could also decide the next warfare, the next war's outcome. It's not just about, you know, kinetic weapons. It's not just about guns. It's not just about trenches. It's not just about tanks anymore. The new systems are going to decide at least the upper hand over the very early parts of the next war. So what should we be doing? Well, this isn't the Utopia Building podcast, but, you know, the U.S. needs, and any country that wants to survive, they need to be building redundant systems, right? They should do some POTS systems, like 20 of them, plain old telephone service, copper wire, command and control networks, come off the grid grids, so to speak. And 1995 internet is light years better than no internet at all. And the U.S. or whoever should be building 20, 30 different internets. You know, just plain old telephone service internets, should be building them, copper wire, and just, you know, use and burn. Switching back and forth between them is necessary if you can, or use and burn while you exercise your command and control. Obviously, electronic systems should be hardened. I assume the United States military has hardened their electronic systems as much as possible against an electromagnetic pulse. For one thing, you could have a Carrington event right from the sun that could damage them, and that could hit just one side of the earth and not the other, right? And that would clearly be an interesting situation if it hit the wrong side of the earth. So that should be happening. I assume that is happening. If you look, there are a bunch of documents out there that you can find in various military information depositories that discuss how bases and how personnel should be handling hardened equipment. So I assume that's going on out there. But in addition to that, Nobody seems to be hardening civilian electronics. The U.S. should be hardening civilian electronics. Absolutely. That should be out there for a million reasons, if not just the fact that keeping your citizenry in the best shape possible during a war gives you more resources, more ability to support the war, and keeps morale up, right? So, and we're definitely not doing that. Nobody's sent me, you know, any information. Oh, here's how you build a Faraday cage around your house, your laptop, whatever. Nobody's talking about that. They should. Finally, attract more talent. Right now, the military's perception in academic circles, or the military's, the way the military is perceived by people in academic circles in the United States is extremely poor. They're not getting, you know, I have a fair number of friends who are in the physics industry or in the academic industry, and the ones who know about defense contracts and work with defense contractors, the U.S. military is not getting the cream of the crop. The U.S. military is not having the geniuses among genius work for them for the most part. There are certainly some exceptions, but what I hear is that it is not the top tier as it was during the days of the Manhattan Project, even when you had Feynman figuring out what went wrong with the space shuttle when Feynman was super old. It's not exactly similar, but it is close enough to be able to say that our military needs to be recruiting academics. They should be spending their recruiting dollars in academics as much as they're trying to recruit 18-year-old kids coming out of high school to lug around MREs everywhere. All right, five, recalibrate where China is going in the future. Are they slowing down? Well, super close-up view, 4.9% growth this quarter instead of the 6% that's the official target for the year. And, of course, the CCP hates to be wrong or to look bad, faces everything. So that 4.9 is probably already a little bit pumped up. And if you look at their GDP per capita growth, they've already hit an inflection point, a real inflection point, right, around 2013. Remember, inflection point doesn't mean where suddenly something starts decreasing. Their GDP per capita is still increasing or starts increasing when it was decreasing. A real inflection point is when your second derivative changes signs, right? So in this case, the rate at which the GDP was increasing went from increasing rate of increase to a decreasing rate of increase, if you will. The curve changed from concave up to concave down right around 2013 or so. Yeah, it's really annoying when people get inflection point wrong. Happens all the time. So, you know, in recent months, until this came out, a lot of the signs coming out of the CCP were bad for the CCP, right? Their economy, they're shutting it down. They're closing it off. They're desperate for energy. They have these blackouts going on. They've banned the culture that is still so popular there that it's still popular even after they banned it. They cracked down on cryptocurrency. That is only going to hurt them, obviously. They are telling their kids aren't allowed to play video games legally unless it's 8 to 9 o'clock on Friday or Saturday and maybe even Sunday. Can't believe that. There have been a couple of good signs out of China, I guess. Evergrande. People are saying Evergrande is a horrible sign for China. It might turn out to be that way, but I will point out that China not bailing out Evergrande, if they continue to not bail them out, that's actually more capitalist than what the United States did in 2008 with the financial firms and General Motors and everything else. That was one of the most socialist things I've ever seen. So in terms of recalibrating where China is going in the future, I say moderate slowdown, but not a crash. And it kind of looked like over the summer they might be heading for a crash. I would say recalibrate to a moderate slowdown. Finally, last point about recalibrating your estimations of things. This should recalibrate your estimation of UFOs, or UAPs, as the Pentagon now calls them. unidentified aerial phenomenon. Remember Mitt Romney coming out and saying last summer 2021, we know these aren't from our peers because our peers don't have this technology. Yeah, obviously he didn't know jack about what our peers are doing. He had no idea. He probably thought he had an idea because he probably trusted the intelligence services. But, you know, I should do a whole UFO podcast on these things. But, you know, you look, a lot of the so-called unexplainable encounters could easily, plausibly be peers. Not maybe the Nimitz encounter. That one is a baffler. But a lot of the other, like the Omaha group in 2018, 2019 off the coast of Southern California, lights swarm in the deck, et cetera, those are almost certainly Chinese, Russian drones, something like that. Another one, like Ryan Graves talking about off the coast of Virginia in 2013, 2014, and then they look just like the radar reflectors that Tyler Rogoway found. Yeah, those could be foreign peers. Absolutely. You know, you have John Ratcliffe, former director of national intelligence. You have Mitt Romney out there saying things like, oh, our peers are not even close to this technology, can't do it, no way. Dangling out there this possibility of UFOs. Now, come on. It's pretty clear they have no idea what the capabilities of our peers are. So you have to go with Occam's razor and say these, at least the vast majority of these so-called unexplained sightings could pretty easily be explained by a competent national intelligence service. So to recap here at the end of the program, the things you should recalibrate after this Chinese fractional orbital bombardment system announcement are, number one, your estimate of the U.S. intelligence system, that should go into the incompetent category. That's easy. Number two, security, national security for the United States. I'd say not a huge change here, back to Cold War bad type scenario, but if that's a huge change for you, then maybe that is a huge change. Your vision of the future of war, again, there will be one, and you should recalibrate, in my opinion, to one that's going to look like a big opening salvo that establishes dominance electronically, and let's hope not biologically, but possibly biologically, over the first short term, and then a long protected war of resistance and attrition after that. And then, of course, how to prepare for the future of war. Like I said, you should be recalibrating in terms of the value of redundant systems, electronic systems, redundant healthcare systems, updating the CDC so that we actually might have a chance against biological agent. Number five was recalibrating where China is going in the future. If you thought that China was having a severe issue based on, or maybe even going away based on what's going on with their swatting, but like CCP, like the old man swatting at anything that moves in the room, banning this, stopping that, putting actresses in jail over the last 6 months. Maybe not so much. Maybe not so much with downgrading your China expectations. I still predict a slowdown there, but maybe not as severe as you might have thought. And finally, UFOs. Not so much UFOs. Probably peer technology in the vast majority of UAP cases. All right, folks. That is it for our look at how we should recalibrate things based on the fractional orbital bombardment system coming out of China. I hope that you have a super day. I will talk to you soon. Take care.